It's a dysfunctional movement of adult males. Like, I was there.
The far right, organized hate groups, white supremacists, anti-Semites, Holocaust deniers have been active in every part of Canada.
The life I led was my choice. So it's my choice to be there, my choice to leave there.
Immigrants are actually not welcome here, sorry.
I think we're seeing an uptick in just the number of organized groups in Canada and the US.
Well, what are the 14 words?
We must secure the existence of our people and a future for white children.
And you see 1488.
88 is Heil Hitler, HH, so eighth letter of the alphabet. You'd say 1488 together.
Hail Trump, hail our people, hail victory.
Like, the dream is to have a white country, an all-white country. Well, I mean, how do we achieve that? You don't.
Like she said, my name is Brad, and I'm a former right-wing extremist. Basically, I was recruited by one of my best friends, and he promised me a life of brotherhood and safety. And, you know, I always wanted to belong to something. I felt like something was always missing in my life. So at 17, 18 years old, I took up this offer, and this led me into the next sort of 13 years of my life where I eventually became the president of an international white supremacist organization.
Brad Galloway is not just a member of a far-right group, white supremacist group, but was, in fact, you know, part of the leadership echelon, if you will. Strong recruiter for the movement, and managed to find his way out.
You feel good when you're there, but when you get out and you start looking back on it and looking over top of everything, you're like, wow, that was terrible for everybody, including myself.
It was a normal childhood, hockey, you know, all the normal things that a Canadian kid does, I did. I was like 15, 16 where I started getting criminal trouble. I kept looking and went to different places to find some sort of belonging, right, with some sort of group of people, and that's where it led me to the skinhead group. He didn't have to convince me, hey, you know, this is cool. You know, he was a tough-looking guy with the jackets and, you know, jeans, boots, you know, the white laces and white power skinhead like band t-shirt on. I was looking for change, and he had this group of guys that he was hanging out with, which sounded really cool to me, right? And then at the concerts, there was always so much beer and just, you know, people, you know, Nazi saluting and all this stuff. It just seemed like these guys were hardcore and really believed in this, right?
White power, 1, 2, 3, 4!
So this is a white power band, a typical sort of album cover. So any concert you'd go to, you could get something like this there. Probably the most prominent white supremacist band of all time, so Screwdriver. You know, you see a Nazi helmet here. Definitely a symbol, the Screwdriver-esque of white power skinheads. This is what most skinhead guys would wear, a pair of Doc Martens, right? I've been on the receiving end of them before, so if they hurt, I wouldn't want to get kicked ever again by them, but they break a rib pretty good, yeah. And these are some books. This is like Mein Kampf. Like I said, some of this is historical stuff. And this is by Dr. Martin Luther called The Jews and Their Lies. So this is early anti-Semitism. So like I said, I'm interested in history. This is Web of Hate. So this is like one of the first books that looked at the far right in Canada. I mean, it was very journalistic, but it was pretty accurate. I know a lot of the people that were profiled in the book.
The far right, organized hate groups, white supremacists, anti-Semites, Holocaust deniers have been active in every part of Canada. So in behind us here, the boardwalk in the lead-up to World War II was a place where swastika clubs, as they called themselves, roamed the boardwalk beating up Jews or people that they thought were Jews. Every province, every region has got this problem. And it ebbs and flows. It drops off periodically, usually in periods where the economy's doing well. It becomes tougher for these guys. But it never goes away fully, and it is active in every part of the country.
Terry Long is a 40-year-old born and raised Albertan. He is also the Canadian leader of the Aryan Nations, a group which believes that whites are chosen people, that Adolf Hitler was a prophet.
We believe that the Jews are Satan's seed, which is right out of Scripture, and and that we are God's seed. We, as the chosen people of Israel, are God's seed.
You know, in the 80s, when society became much more preoccupied with equal rights for gays and lesbians, that became their preoccupation. Abortion, you know, because Jewish doctors, they would claim, did abortions. Whatever was hot, they would glom onto. And, you know, presently it's refugees and immigrants. But it doesn't really matter. Like, the issue changes all the time for these guys. It's just, it's hate. They just hate, you know, other people.
Do you think I've ever asked this before? Do you think you were a Nazi?
Nope. There's nothing wrong with reading about it, and there's nothing wrong with, but I'm Canadian. So I always took that into consideration when I was looking at my views. And it was even tough doing, you know, you have to do the Nazi salute at concerts or whatever it is to fit in. You gotta have a lot of beers to do that.
You know, in the early days, I helped organize it, right? I was very keen on the ideology, and so that gave me that sense of power. In terms of being powerless, I never felt powerless. That feeling was gone when I was with them.
His family doesn't support him. He says he's lost a lot of friends, too. Despite that, McAleer has persevered. His most recent effort, a computer-aided telephone line.
You have reached the Canadian Liberty Net, Canada's first computer-operated voice message center to promote cultural and racial awareness amongst white people.
And we believe that the white race, you know, we talk about white genocide, right? That the white race was under threat, that there was this hive mind of Jews that controlled governments and finance and opened the doors of immigration into Western countries so that the white race would be flooded out and washed away. And we were going to be the vanguard to defend that. And if you had nothing going on, and all of a sudden now you're part of this movement that's exciting, and the music is seductive, and the people that are talking you into joining are seductive, it's easy to see how young people get drawn in and emotionally connected.
So this is the type of place that we used to have, like, concerts at, community halls, whether it be cultural centers or, like you said, like, scout places or something. Like, it was always something that was, you know, try to fly under the radar, but
absolutely
everybody knew about it anyways. It was kind of, you know, trying to be incognito about everything, right? But
meeting at the Free Speech Club.
Yeah, the Free Speech Club, yes.
When we go to join violent extremist groups, because we're not getting that acceptance, attention, approval, we excommunicate ourselves from friends, family, society. We join the group. When we decide to leave, we excommunicate ourselves again. And we find ourselves in the middle, I call it the void, where you have no social group. And it's an incredibly lonely space to be. And most people can't handle the loneliness. And they will choose the dysfunction of the group and go back rather than face the time to be alone.
Definitely that music was prime target for the recruitment tool, right? And then, of course, the literature, you'd have the magazines from whatever groups. Or
if you could create the event and invite someone into it, and then mm-hmm. it's that sense of camaraderie. There's the energy, the music, mm-hmm. and for someone who's been bullied or getting beat up at school, mm-hmm. you know, by people of a different race and they're white kids.
Oh, yeah. They feel automatically.
Automatically, like I could feel safe with these guys where they may not have felt safe otherwise. And we took advantage of it.
I know I had a part in that. I mean, it's just like any other kind of business strategy, right? You want to get more members in or like, you know.
I met Brad three and a half years ago. He reached out to Life After Hate.
When I left, there was nothing, you know, I went from the white power music scene, kind of bumbled and stumbled. Mm-hmm. There was no one mm-hmm. who made that journey before me.
For someone like Brad, it's a tough journey. A lot of people go down the road and quit. But Brad hasn't. He's stuck with it, and I'm really pleased to see him. He's one of the people that have come through Life After Hate and are saying, like, how can I help now too?
When they say they're just coming out, I tend to be cynical about that. I want to see a lot of proof, and I want to see a lot of atonement. I want to see the mea culpa. I want to see them make up for the hurt and the pain, in some cases the physical pain, that they have caused. It's not enough to say, I don't believe that anymore. It's like, no. You have to do more than that, because you caused harm. You terrorized people. You hurt people. You have to change, and you've got to prove it to us. The onus is on you.
So when, how long are you in Toronto for?
About a week.
About a week. Okay.
Yeah. So I'm working with Fighting Anti-Semitism Together, which is a group that is trying to work with high school students to educate them about general anti-racist actions within the society.
Which is behind you.
It's a huge change for me.
Sorry.
9 years ago, I probably would have been doing the opposite in seeking ways to attach myself to racist ideologies, but now I think giving back to the community is important, especially when I took away from it.
So this will be interesting for me. Okay. So I don't know if you know about my background. My mother's a Holocaust survivor.
Oh, okay.
So
it's much easier to hate than it is to try and spread positivity amongst the community, right? So it's much easier just to say no, screw everything, right? So
when you talk about those guys that were trying to project that onto you, what do you think they'll think if they see this PSA?
Well, a few of them are dead, so they're not going to think a lot about it. But, you know, the grand scheme of things, probably not so great. But, I mean, what do you do? I mean, hopefully they've moved on too, right?
And I remember her telling me stories, even after they came to Canada. For 2 years, she slept under the bed. You know, like, it destroyed her because she was fearful someone would come and take her away.
And which is important to know, though. It's important to hear that stuff, because if you're willing to take on anti-Semitic beliefs, you should know what you're really believing in. And if you can't teach your children it, it's probably not something that you can't live within it with yourself, right? If you can't pass it down a generation, like, how can you believe in that yourself? When I sort of started to attach myself to the belief system surrounding, you know, white supremacy or whatever way you want to use to describe it, I started to really identify how prominent they were in the community, right? The guy who recruited me, he always said to me, like, look at them, they're so different, like, how could that ever work with our culture here? Like, look at how they're bringing their culture and then springing up their businesses, their, you know, restaurants, their cultural stuff. And we have to, you know, fight to get those things back. A lot of times I think it is exactly fear, right? I think it is that people are always fearing something that isn't their own culture, right?
They're losers. They are, you know, failures. They're losers who have lost out on life, and they become embittered and angry and hateful about that. And the attraction that the far right movement has in them is obvious. It's shock troops. It's guys to go and do their dirty work. So you'll get these older men, whether it's an Ernst Zundel or a Jim Keegster or a Terry Long, whoever it is, they bring them in, and they're quite expert at manipulating them. And when you think of it, it makes sense. You know, they give them a uniform. They give them a code of belief. They give them a family to belong to.
Paul Fromm is a man who's got fine educational credentials.
I find a lot of the speakers, inclusive of like David Duke, Paul Fromm, these guys, they have similar rhetoric. So they're trying to sugarcoat anti-Semitism and racism and things like that with this, my theory of the marginalization of the white race.
We want North America to remain European. We want the founding settler stock to remain in charge.
This is Paul Fromm speaking at a white supremacist rally in 1990.
In closing, let me say...
Last year at a race relations meeting, he yelled scalp them at an Aboriginal speaker.
Throw them out.
Paul Fromm has been associated with the right-wing movement in Canada for the better part of 3 decades, maybe longer. But my awareness of him earlier in life, before I got involved with the far right, was that I had read a news story that he was a teacher and he had lost his job because allegedly he was trying to indoctrinate students with far-right identity politics kind of stuff.
One of the characters that I've talked to, a guy named Brad Galloway.
I've heard of him, yes.
Was he a major character?
Well, he was the leading force in the Vancouver chapter. You know, he'd call meetings, people would come to his house, there'd be some politics and some drinking. And so, I mean, he was the one who made things happen. I remember being at his house for a couple of house meetings. I don't remember a lot, but would he describe himself as a neo-Nazi?
Fromm now is the leading Canadian far-right leader. Keegstra is dead, Doug Christie is dead, Terry Long has disappeared. A lot of them have drifted away. And Fromm's kind of the only guy left standing. But he's always very careful, as he will be with you. He'll never use the N-word. He'll never, you know, call a Jew a kike or anything like that. He will always... be sophisticated in the way he presents his arguments. But, be under no illusion, he is a white supremacist. He is a neo-Nazi. And that is what he's believed forever.
You know, Canadians are, I mean, we're a broken, cowardly people. We really are. We've apologized to every imaginable group in this country so that when they have power, they will use it and for their own benefit. Rightly so. It's only dumb Europeans that feel they've got to save everybody else and don't advance their own interests. It won't be pretty at all. So I guess the number one priority is to get control of immigration.
My daddy served in the army. Well, he lost his right eye, but he flew a flag out in our yard. To the day that he died, he wanted my mother, my brother, my sister, and me to grow up and live happy in the land of the free.
Donald Trump has given a lot of people hope. And Donald Trump has also seized some of the issues that you're not supposed to talk about. The United States has its own taboos. Their population also is being replaced. Trump doesn't talk about that directly, but Trump has talked about the hordes of illegals. And that was controversial. It shouldn't be. I mean, if they're illegal, throw them out. But people love that because here finally was a businessman's direct approach to, here's a problem, I've got here's the solution, and I'm going to do it.
And that's what you see here today is this sea of patriots, warriors, and lovers of liberty and freedom. We've had enough. We're standing up.
to the communists. The Antifa that have assembled here across the street, these guys are domestic terrorists. These are Trotskyite stormtroops. They are hardline communists that wish to destroy Western civilization and upon its ashes build a communist dystopia.
Okay. I'm going to stop it there. So this guy is a right-wing extremist, for sure, right? So he's talking about communism. Again, the paranoia, Trotskyists, naming them all these different left-wing ideologies. Like, let's be honest. Are we really afraid of communism right now? Like,
but these guys are.
But they are. Are they really afraid of communism, or is it Jews that they're trying to talk about? What are they really talking about? What's the message behind that? Because that's the typical message, is that Jews are behind communism. So there's going to be radical racism behind this anti-communist stuff. It's obviously we're not scared of communism. What are they really scared of, though?
See, that's interesting to me because I don't hear that, right? Yeah. I don't know. I'm not attuned to it.
Yeah.
Right?
He's only presenting half of the ideology, right? So what he wants to tell you, too, is, well, here's the perpetrators of Marxism. And, I mean, who made up communism? This was not made up by Caucasian Christian males from North America. This is made up by, you know, European Jews, right? So, I mean, these are white supremacists. So I don't care what he wants to say about it.
He knew he wanted to move away from the movement. I think there was occasionally some temptation to sort of sink back into that because imagine the struggle, you know.
It's more for the shirts that I did this photo.
He hadn't sort of, I think, repeated his story enough times that he was comfortable with it. I think he was still almost embarrassed or ashamed to talk about that history very openly. You know, since then, he's doing the best he can to change his life and the lives of others as well.
Well, yeah, there's like this photo here. So there's me, bomber jacket on and shaved head, right?
How old are you there?
21-ish, I think. So, and then there's like this photo here is a group of us. So I'm there in the middle with the Life Ruin flag. That's probably, I'm probably 25 in that photo. So again, just a group of guys hanging out, you know, all same sort of dress. That's kind of the idea, right? And you see us, me and this friend here, like we're got the same coat on with the patches, right?
What are the patches? You've talked about patches. What do they signify?
I mean, that patch could be anything, but if they're all the same and we all belong to the same thing, there's that empowerment about it. Whether you're a white power skinhead or a traditional skinhead or whatever, but if you've all got the same deal going on, I believe it's an empowering sort of brotherhood kind of thing, right? That's all your friends. So imagine one day just leave your friends behind. Yeah, sure. I mean, it was tough. I don't know, it's not, all of a sudden you're free and clear of you know, that life that you once had. But this is part of it. I'm not hiding who I am. One night specifically, ran into some Vietnamese gang members that used to be hanging out on the street, selling dope or, you know, whatever, smoking in front of bars or whatever. And a fight started with them, and it looked like that was gonna go pretty bad. A bunch of them poured out of a sort of a karaoke joint that isn't there anymore.
I think there was 20 of them. I'm not sure. All I can remember is them coming towards me. One guy had a belt he pulled off, and it looked like it had a knife about that long on the end of it. And I remember getting hit with it and then sort of staggering around because I was bleeding a lot.
Hello. Do you know where you are?
And I was laying on this bed or whatever it was. And in walks this doctor. And I noticed he was Orthodox Jewish guy. And I'm sitting there and I've got some white power shirt on and dressed up like a skinhead, right? And I'm like, crap, this guy's not gonna help me. Like, That's all I could think. This guy's never going to help me. I think back to it, and I think, you know, people are people, and we should care about each other, just like that guy did. So that's what I saw in him, like it just that instance. You know, I think back and help me change, anyways.
But so, not Ben.
No, I had something I had to put to the side. I had to compartmentalize that and say, I can't tell guys about how I feel about that. Like that's, you know. Guy saved my life, and that's good, but I gotta move on from that. I gotta call it I almost died, and you know, get celebrated at the next skinhead thing for, you know, the more crimes you commit, the more respect you get, blah blah blah.
Hateful symbols and words scrawled in red paint on places of worship at one of Ottawa's biggest synagogues, at a United Church with a black minister, and at an Ottawa mosque.
It's terrifying, right? And that's the intent, right? It is to instill terror, to instill fear. It's meant to send the message not just to those victims, but to others like them, that they're just not welcome there.
Currently, I'm studying at the University of the Fraser Valley to get my Bachelor of Criminology and Criminal Justice, which is, it's been an ongoing thing over the last 3.5 years sort of thing.
I wonder if, in a sense, by studying criminology, you're actually kind of studying yourself.
Yeah, there's aspects of that I've thought about, like especially behavior in my adolescence, like being radicalized, stuff like that.
It's rare for them to stay in for very long. I remember a cop saying to me once that, you know, the reason that people leave the movement is because they begin to hate so much, they begin to hate themselves, they begin to hate one another, and they just have to walk away from it. And I think that it finally built up for Brad that he moved away from that.
It's sort of went wrong, because I would say the birth of the street gang in Toronto, Ontario, was due to these guys. You know, they would be marching. You'd hear these guys coming a mile away, like marching like an army.
Yeah.
You know, boots and and then you would hear the rock going, and you knew, run, get the hell out. If you ain't white, get the hell out of there. You know, because they'll ask you, they'll approach you. And they used to circle you and stuff, and smileys and all that. Like, it was bad.
One of the main things that was the violence. That's why I wanted to get away from it. It was so negative, and it's consuming, as you guys would know, too. Like, you almost lose sight of how regular people, you know, operate with some of the, from day to day, with some of the things that I know I was involved in.
How to deal with it.
Somebody has to deal with it. And I got sick of, you know, planning and operating my life like that. It was just not, you know, it's hate also is very consuming. It takes up so much energy to do this type of stuff. It just became so, like, tiring.
I ended up getting work in Vancouver. Maybe I could start something of my own, who knows, right? You know, I had the movement back east. I learned stuff from Toronto. Take it to BC. Maybe see if there's like another group of guys we can get together and create another group of like skinhead guys, right? So I managed my way and found some guys that believed in that same stuff out here. Via internet. The main thing here is the South Asian population. Like they were the direct targets. Like Jews and Muslims and that wasn't a thing. A few of us branched out and started, you know, trying to get some formal thing going. There's this group from the States called Volksfront that started in Portland. Eventually we had a chapter in Vancouver with me and my buddies, right? So which, to do so, you'd have to go down to Portland a bunch of times to visit them and be, you know, show that, you know, you're interested in the group and hang out and gain trust.
Volksfront wanted to reframe itself not just as a gang, but as a white civil rights organization. So it starts off as sort of a skinhead gang, but then it really starts promoting itself as a way of educating young white people. Well, they would hang outside high schools in the area and recruit white kids, and they say, hey, do you have, you know, gay kids in your school to get better treatment than you do? Or are there immigrant kids that get special rights? And, you know, we want to talk to you about why they're trying to make you feel guilty for being white.
And they talked a lot of stuff about, like, you know, healing the woes of the white race from before. Not so much about the hatred aspect, like the real crazy out there stuff about, like, mass murder, all this type of stuff. Like, they were talking about just separating and creating a white homeland. And Portland was the center.
Portland is very, Oregon period is based around the white supremacy. It's been since the state's been built. And you're dealing with, especially with Trump in office, you're dealing with more of the movement coming back to life. It was underground for a while, but now you got people that are in fear of walking out their own doors because, you know, of the movement coming back to life.
There is this feeling that this is Portlandia and we're somehow past all these problems. We're in a liberal oasis, and so we really don't have to concern ourselves with them too much. When you find out about the history that created this place that is very white, it's unsettling and it's violent. So the Coon Chicken Inn was sort of a famous chicken spot 60, 70 years ago, based on the sort of cartoon characterization of African Americans as fried chicken loving, watermelon eating pickaninnies. It highlights what Portland was like mid-century, that it was a very segregated city. I mean, many people knew it as the most segregated Jim Crow city west of the Rockies, so, and maybe even west of the Mississippi. And the fact that the Coon Chicken Inn was already here sort of just added to the notion that this was a very unwelcoming place to people of color.
Sarah and two other companions were attacked last November. Witnesses say Sarah was kicked by defendants and hit over the head repeatedly with a baseball bat. Defense lawyers questioned.
I think one of the things that really kind of put Portland on the map that it is well known is the murder of Mulugeta Sarah, the Ethiopian immigrant who moved here, escaping a pretty horrible environment in Ethiopia in the 1980s.
Kyle Brewster, Stephen Strasser, and Ken Miskey are accused of kicking and beating Sarah to death. Prosecution calls attack racially motivated.
And this is also the area that was the hotbed of the Portland skinhead gang, Eastside White Pride, led by this guy named Ken Miskey, who went by the name Ken Death. And the crime sort of happened when these two populations kind of bumped into each other. A fight broke out. Ken went back to the car and his girlfriend Julie handed him a baseball bat and he came out swinging. This is the spot where Mulugeta Sarah died. You know, Portland now is a place that is known for having roving gangs of murderous Nazi skinheads, and so who's going to be the next target? Ken Miskey was sentenced to 30 years in prison and he died recently in prison. So it was just starting to feel like the Sarah murder was setting in the sunset of our collective consciousness when this past May, a young man named Jeremy Christian had been on kind of a tirade through the whole spring, going around shouting at people about immigration and about the white man's world disappearing. He was popping up at some alt-right rallies, Zig Heiling, and professing his allegiance to the white race. He's on the commuter train that heads eastward from downtown and sees two young dark-skinned women, one who is wearing hijab, and starts again in his anti-immigrant tirades. And three white men, as it were, stood up and asked him to stop, told him to get off the train, tried to stand between him and the young women who immediately got off at the next stop. They were afraid for their lives. And Christian pulled out a knife and very quickly stabbed each three of them repeatedly in the neck. This is the platform where the crime really happened, where the men kind of fell out of the train bleeding and two of them passed away right here. And then just almost organically, the station became a de facto memorial with people bringing flowers and candles and writing messages in chalk. And I noticed someone had written in chalk, "Remember Mulugeta Sarah," connecting these two events. And then I saw two little girls with chalk drawing hearts on the pavement, writing the names of the victims. And my little girl loves to draw in chalk on the pavement, and I just burst into tears because, you know, I went from being the expert or the commentator to a father and a human being. I was thinking, how am I going to explain this to my daughter that things like this happen?
There's no point to it at the end of it. At the end of the day, there's no point to it. So you gotta find a good time and throw in the towel. The United States Customs, basically, if you get yourself involved in any sort of criminality, you may end up finding yourself on their short list of people who cannot travel anymore. So. You know, it's hard to get back those simple freedoms that we overlook, right? Because you can't get jobs, because now you've associated yourself with this group, which is founded by felons. So I'm losing jobs, I'm losing travel, I'm losing all these things because of these groups. So how is this making me better as a person? Like, it's not the Jewish government that's stopping it. It's actually me being involved in the group. Like, that's their ideology. Oh, the Jews, they're running your life, you know, they're taking over your life. No, that's the group that's ruining it, because you're felons.
So I could start and then, and you can jump in.
Yes.
So I think, first of all, it's really good to be able to sit down with you and have this conversation, because I think this is something that a lot of people want to understand, because...
Well, Randy and I sort of, over the last year, have developed a professional relationship.
Cost of not joining them.
I sort of reached out to him on an off chance that maybe he'd want to work on a piece, because I always liked his writing from the time that he used to research the Portland skinhead scene.
What would you have thought of him when you were still in Bookstore?
We used to hate it when he'd come out with a story, because it was like he was telling the real thing that was going on, right? So that kind of stank.
What was the moment like when you were coming out of prison? Were you thinking, well, I'm still in this group and I'm still going to be a good soldier and carry on? Or was it just another chapter in this experience? Or was there a temptation just to walk away from it all?
I still carried it on when I left the streets. I still got involved with other people that got out before I did. And we went around beating up minorities and stuff like that. With Trump being in office and everything else, he's given the okay message to do whatever you want. You know, if I was still in the movement, I would be out there running the streets, you know, because you got a president that's in control of the world, you know, in the United States, and he's our mascot.
I guess whatever the reasons are for us to, you know, get away from the movement, I think that first year is so elemental to where, you know, setting up the stage for the next few years. And for me, it's been, yeah, 5.5, 6 years or whatever it is. I think we can't live in fear. Like, we can't live in fear. We're going to do this instead.
You know, part of it getting out, you know, it's like when I finally decided to leave everything, I got rid of the boots, I got rid of everything. And then, you know, I end up getting my tattoos covered up. I just don't want a reminder of all that stuff, you know, because it's like a drug addiction, you know.
The original trajectory upwards in gangs was to find belonging. But now I belong to the educational environment, so that's fine. We need to find that new sense, or outside of school, it belonged to a job as well, and family. So you attach to those rather than the negative peers. So I found another route to span it out and occupy different areas of my life. Before, it was just that occupied the whole thing. Like, I'm sure there's trauma there that I had during that time. But I mean, I believe it's for me to process and for each person to process and go through that process, right? And I believe the process will be for a long time. It's not gonna be simple.
Do you think that you feel it's still with you?
Well, yeah, we're here talking about it, right? So it's, but this is part of it. The dialogue is so helpful. Because imagine sitting there with it just stagnant inside of a person, what type of person that person might become. So how do you just compartmentalize all that and get by it?
I just have a question for Mr. Galloway. Seeing as how you spent like so much of your time inside of that culture, did you find that the knowledge that you were passing down to your kids was hard to erase, or was that something that was just easily done?
That's one of the main reasons why I got out, because I couldn't pass down those belief systems to my kids. I couldn't see myself sitting there and teach my child to hate other children, you know, based on their race or their culture or their, you know, how could it, I couldn't do that.
So I just wanted to ask you that again, if you could just help clear that up, mm-hmm. about why, you know, you chose to go this alone and not involve your family.
Well, first of all, I mean, the answer is not simple, but it's close family. This is my social change exercise for me. This is me trying to give back. They weren't ever a party to this. This is not their thing. You know, family's there, and they're meant to do what they're going to do. But this is what I'm going to do. This is my single journey on this one. I will say that they are one of the main reasons that can pull a person out, like the push-pull mechanisms, that they definitely had this innate ability to pull me out and keep me positive, to get me away from it and rebuild, right? The end game is, yeah, like there was a bunch of incidents, and there was one that happened at my house, and my wife and kid were there. They're at my house saying they want to end Volksfront or end me or whatever their point was, but violently remove me from the mix of the movement. And I look over and there's my daughter banging on the glass, you know, daddy, that, you know, whatever. And I'm sitting there having to deal with this lot of idiots, right? And that's all I can think about is, man, I just want them off my property so I can just go in there and hold my daughter, just like be a father to my kid. Gone are the days of going and meeting in pubs, and that was how you met guys. Now it was like, you know, go online, go on a white power website and meet some guys. Stormfront, that website, it's like one of the oldest websites, period. Like it's just, it's in the early 90s, right? And it had progressed to having chat forums for all the countries, all the white countries around the world, right? So for any kid or any young person to go online, they can find something.
Stormfront essentially is the hub of the movement online. So what we're doing for a project is we're essentially looking at online discussions on Stormfront and other sites as well. We want to know how people are discussing their adversary groups. So if you take a look at this list over here, some of the key groups that the right-wing extremist movement challenge or are against are obviously Jews, Blacks, and LGBTQs. So we want to know essentially who's discussing what. So what we do is we generate these lists of really negative terms around these three groups, for example, and then we go through on Stormfront and we see who's discussing them and the context in which they're discussing them.
So who takes the most abuse?
Jews by far take the most abuse. The messages are targeted at them at the highest volume. However, on the other hand, what's particularly interesting is the discussions around LGBTQs is the most vile. It's the most negative and it's the most hateful.
So you know who these people are?
I know who a lot of them are, yeah. Some of the most radical people are very well-known right-wing extremists, whether they're ideologues, whether they're people who have engaged in violence, whether they're people who are in the streets kind of screaming and yelling.
And David Duke's involved with this too.
David Duke's involved, and so is Paul Fromm. Paul Fromm has his own radio station as well. He's a very active member, not only within the Canadian sub-forum, but across the different forums. He's very, very active. Very active. These ideologues won't engage in violence themselves, but they'll promote violence, and that's what we're seeing oftentimes online. So the internet is very powerful in that sense. It offers people a space, an unchallenged space, in which they can spread their hatred.
When I
I come into a room packed like this, I kind of want to be closer to the wall or closer to the door, you know?
I still sit in restaurants with my back facing
the wall. Absolutely. Always. You never not face the door.
I feel like really
rule number one. That's 101. Yeah.
Well, we got through it, right? We survived.
That's right.
Sorry, it's kind of bent or whatever. Yeah, no doubt. No, it's really interesting. Yeah.
I guess this was the first event where I noticed skinheads. It was grade 9, and I was at Royal York subway station waiting for my girlfriend at the time, who was Polish. And there was at least 50. And they marched, and they looked like they were going to march right past. And they stopped right in front of us, turned to me. They'd made this kind of formation, half-circle crescent around where I was sitting. And then the biggest, meanest-looking skinhead that I've ever seen, you know, just came and told me to stand up. Then he asked me questions along the lines of what my bloodline, you know, what kind of mongrel race person I was, da-da-da-da. And I was just terrified. So I was kind of like, sir, I'm just here waiting for my girlfriend. And he's like, that's your girlfriend? And as soon as they kind of directed their attention towards her, I became defensive. I'm not going to fight 50 guys. But like, just like, guys, please leave us alone. Please leave us alone. And it was actually a female whose head was shaved at the side. She had maybe a little bit of hair at the top.
The Chelsea cut.
Punched me, bam, punched me in the face. Yeah. And kind of stumbled me back because I thought, you know, I'm there looking for more fists to come. I look to my left and I see a bunch of black kids running down the stairs, and it was an organized, you know, an organized fight between the two. But that was like really my very first run-in with skinheads. Now, I have people from back then calling me, like, almost like roll call, like, what are we doing? When are we suiting up?
Yeah.
And I'm kind of like, You know, as far as, like, what's going on with Trump, they're sending me articles about these new groups that are rising again. And some of these kids, they're looking at us, the old leaders, who are now out of this way of life. But, you know, are we going to be forced back into it? Or, like, is it going to be forced to have protection groups again? Are we going to be forced to, you know, is violence the only way type of thing?
It just makes me think back, like, all the young lives that were lost on either side, right?
Oh, yeah.
Like, young kids. I remember some young kid, you know, he got killed by a black gang. He was a skinhead kid in the same subway station, right? Because of this hatred or whatever he had for people. And that's what that inspires. That violence inspires more violence.
Right.
You're going to get the privileged folks that join these so-called groups. I won't call it alt-right groups. I'll call them white supremacist groups.
Yeah.
Because that's all it is. It's, I believe it's all the same. I don't think there's any sense.
I was going to say, there's a difference?
There's no difference. They're all, it's the same message.
What I mean is, they're meant to be?
Well,
between Nazi and ultra-right and white supremacists?
This is what they're presenting. They're presenting this new thing that is very old, actually, because I was a proprietor of this idea. It was marginalization of white people.
America was, until this past generation, a white country designed for ourselves and our posterity.
Nothing has changed.
No, it's the same thing. It's just different people. They're dressed a little differently. They're not all white supremacist skinheads or white power skinheads.
Wearing suits, looks like bankers. I can't remember the last time I seen a bald head in like a bomber jacket.
No.
Tell you the truth.
It doesn't sound like white supremacy when it's coming from a guy in a polo shirt.
For sure.
But then, it to me, it almost sounds like more of it.
Absolutely.
Because now you've got a guy in expensive clothing saying, immigrants are ruining my country.
They're bringing drugs. They're bringing crime. They're rapists.
Like, I explain this when I talk with students a lot, right? Like, anybody can become later involved in these gangs or in these extremist movements or whatever. It's not limited to poor kids, rich kids. It doesn't matter. I think my message is, you know,
understand by adopting these types of extreme ideologies, that's you signing up to losing those years of your life. I'm going to challenge it. I'm going to do more good to balance out that old bad image, right? Like, you've taken out so much, now it's time to just try and put back. You will definitely lose time, and you will be affecting others negatively. You will be, like, your life will stop for those years. You will lose that time in your life. First, it's great, you know, hey, you got all these buddies around and it's so great, but then you realize how negative it is, so, like, between violence, the hatred, the fear that goes along with, like, you know, walking around in that outfit. It's like, it's just a cult of egos. The male egos fighting each other for to be the most prominent guy there, most prominent group. So that's the way it works. Like, it just, and at the end of the day, it accomplishes nothing. There's no honor, that's for sure. And that's where they talk about that their premise lies in, is the honor, and there isn't any. Like, there's none.